May it please the court and my honorable opponent, I'm Blaine Myrie, counsel for defendant appellant. Colorado Supreme Court has said that a 35C motion may be denied without an evidentiary hearing only where the motion, files, and record in the case clearly establish that the allegations presented in the motion are without merit and do not warrant post-conviction relief. On this record, this case needs to go back for an evidentiary hearing on the conflict-free counsel claim. The communication problems in this case are revealed early on in the record. A hearing on July 15, 1997, which was less than a month after the offense, the public defender, Mr. McClure, noted that the communication had been quite difficult with Mr. Moore. And the court inquired at that time if Mr. Moore was not being responsive, to which Mr. McClure replied, yes. And this is in the sealed transcript. Several other times in that transcript, Mr. McClure noted the communications difficulty, as did his co-counsel, Mr. Lobato, noted that the communication was difficult and that was one of the reasons they were bringing this to the court with a request for a competency evaluation. So within a month of the case being brought, there was communication difficulties between counsel and Mr. Moore. Now, Mr. Moore was then sent to the state hospital for a competency evaluation, and around the time that was completed, but before the competency issue had been ruled on, he sent a letter to the trial judge, and this is at page 26 of the paper record, in which he raised concerns about Mr. McClure as his counsel and specifically requested new counsel, a private lawyer for him. He said, "I don't think Mr. McClure or Sam McClure is satisfying my needs on my case. To me, he's not taking this very seriously." At a hearing about 10 days later, September 15, 1997, the trial court noted that it reviewed the letter and that it guessed it had to address it. It asked Mr. Moore if he had anything further to add to the letter, at which point Mr. Moore responded, "Conflict of interest." The court asked, "What conflict of interest is there?" Mr. Moore replied, "My lawyer." The court asked, "Anything else you want to add?" And Mr. Moore said, "We're not getting along on an assigned level. Anything else? I want a new lawyer." But other than asking anything else, the trial court made no more specific inquiry into the conflict of interest. The court did not address defense counsel, did not ask either Mr. McClure or Mr. Lobato if they were still having communication problems or if there was a conflict that created a need for appointed counsel or a change in counsel. The court didn't ask Mr. Moore specifically what was the conflict of interest problems that he was having. Was it communication problems? Was it strategy problems? And so the inquiry that the trial court was supposed to undertake never happened. It was a perfunctory two pages of the transcript where he essentially asked the same question over and over.
Mr. Myrie, can you clarify for us what standard you think is applicable here? Is it the Kyler standard or is it the Strickland standard?
It would be the Kyler standard. The question was it a conflict of interest that rose to the level of an actual conflict? And if it was an actual conflict, then did it adversely affect the lawyer's performance? But it does not require prejudice to be proven like it would under the Strickland standard.
So we have a new case, West versus People, that came out about 2-3 weeks ago, maybe a month. And it seems to require perhaps more than the Castro case did in terms of proving some kind of adverse effect. Could you address that for us?
Yes, and I apologize if my knowledge of West isn't what it should be, but my understanding of the West case is that it had to do with a concern about either successive or concurrent representation. In other words, were the lawyers representing, say, the defendant and the witness, or had previously represented a witness. So I'm not sure that West would even apply to these circumstances, because this is not what we call a witness conflict, where it happens with a public defender where they represent both the defendant and, you know, possibly the victim or a witness in the case. We see that all the time, a lot in death penalty litigation, for example. But I don't think that West standard would apply here, absent an extension by either this court or by the state Supreme Court of the West rule. I think the concern here still falls under the old Castro standard, which does not require what West requires in the circumstance. So I think that the short answer is West is a situation that doesn't address what happened here, where the conflict is, the potential conflict was a total breakdown of communication or conflict animosity so strong between Mr. Moore and Mr. McClure that Mr. McClure could not render effective assistance of counsel. So the court didn't undertake the type of analysis that is suggested in the Bergerud case or other cases where the court looks at the nature of the complaint and examines the extent of the attorney-client conflict to determine if there's a total breakdown in communication, in which case there's a Sixth Amendment problem, or there's otherwise a problem that prevents an adequate defense from being presented. So the trial court, in other words, the court hearing the trial, did not engage in that analysis. Moving forward to what the 35C court did, the 35C court failed to appreciate the requirement of the need for this type of an inquiry. And the result was that the 35C court essentially deferred to what the trial court did and said that the trial court had found insufficient reason and therefore that argument fails. The 35C court didn't go into the analysis of what the trial court was required to do and whether there was enough in the record to require an evidentiary hearing. And I think the standard is that a hearing has to be held unless everything else clearly shows that there was no possibility that the claim could be valid. And I don't think we have that here. We do have these things in the record that indicate a serious communication problem, not to mention Mr. Moore's ongoing mental problems due in large part to his having been shot and lost part of his brain. There is more in the record that indicates that their communication problems were ongoing. If you look at page, it's a motion that begins at page 56 of the record, the first volume of the paper record, that was filed in September of 98 by the public defender. And that motion sought the appointment of a forensic psychiatrist as an advisory witness, in other words, to sit at counsel table in order to, I guess, facilitate the relationship between Mr. Moore and his counsel, because there was concerns expressed in that motion that Mr. Moore would be uncommunicative, irrational, or even incompetent, in which case the proceedings would have to be halted. To that motion, the public defender attached an affidavit from another public defender who had represented Moore in April 1998, so during the course of the representation here, in connection with a misdemeanor case that was tried also, I believe, in Pueblo County. And her affidavit said that by the conclusion of that trial, a misdemeanor trial, she was entirely unable to communicate with Alonzo in any manner consistent with his assisting in his defense. And so that's the concern here. The communication problems were still an issue for the public defender in 1998. And then, of course, you have what happened at trial, the sort of blow-up between Mr. McClure and Mr. Moore. And some of this is in the record, the comment where Mr. McClure said that Mr. Moore had called him, quote, a sellout motherfucker, close quote. And that's the April 30th, 1999 transcript. And that was in connection with the court instructing Mr. McClure to tell Mr. Moore not to make eye contact with prospective jurors. And Mr. Moore seemed to react pretty unfavorably to that. But there's also allegations made in the 35C motion that the issue of race had come up, that Mr. Moore viewed that there was racial animosity, and it's not necessarily clear where that was coming from, that he made a comment to Mr. McClure that implied that Mr. McClure was a racist, and Mr. McClure sort of just shrugged it off or laughed it off, I think. Upset Mr. Moore further. But in any event, it's clear that there was some sort of a conflict going on during jury selection, and that the issue of communication may not have been resolved. these are the things in the record that indicate to the 35C court that it should have had an evidentiary hearing to address whether there, in fact, was such a breakdown of communication between Mr. Moore and Mr. McClure that that new counsel had to be appointed. And I think it's important to note that this issue was first raised by Mr. Moore very early on in the proceedings. So, yes, this was happening at trial, but the issue had been raised at the outset of the proceeding, probably in connection with Mr. McClure requesting the competency evaluation.
How was trial counsel's performance affected?
Well, what it raised in the 35C motion are a couple of comments. First, the concern about jury selection, about one juror being put on the stand or being put on a jury whose mother had been a murder victim, and Mr. Moore being extremely concerned about that. Now, the argument could be, of course, that that was a strategic call, but without having the ability to really figure out what was in the public defender's mind when they were doing it and what was the colloquy between Mr. Moore and Mr. McClure at that time, we can't know for sure that that wasn't just a case of exasperation on Mr. McClure's part where he just wanted to get this case over with and be done with this difficult client.
But doesn't the defendant have to allege here that there was in fact an actual conflict and the conflict affected trial counsel's performance?
Well, I believe the conflict is alleged, the conflict being the
actual conflict is alleged? It looks as though the conflict that is alleged is that Mr. Moore didn't like this guy one bit.
Well, I think that's true. I think there's no doubt about that.
I'm not sure that's a conflict.
Well, it's a conflict if it results in such a breakdown in communication that Mr. McClure couldn't discharge his ability to get effective.
And that's why I ask you about how was his trial performance impacted.
Yeah. The other issue, I think, is with regard to jury instructions. Granted, the 35C motion is pro se, and it says that the failure to instruct on a lesser included. Well, there was a lesser included that was given, but what wasn't given was a mental impairment defense that they had originally noticed that they were going to raise, and also a heat of passion argument that arguably could have been raised, but was not. Now, some of that appears in the 35C and some does not. That's sort of the problem with having this pro se 35C. But what was mentioned was the animus between counsel resulted in a breakdown of communication and impairing the efforts. That's why the evidentiary hearing was necessary from the 35C court. I see that my time is getting low, so I'm going to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Elizabeth Rohrbaugh and I represent the people of the state of Colorado in this case. It's the people's position that either this appeal should be dismissed as untimely, or alternatively, that this court should affirm the trial court's 2011 order. Briefly, with regard to the timeliness issue, I think it's important to note that the defendant, acting pro se, appealed his 2009 order from the trial court, thus showing both that he has the ability to act pro se and also that his mental disabilities don't impair his ability to do so. So I think then when we look at what happened in 2011, promptly after this case was remanded on October 28, 2011, the trial court issued a written order denying the defendant's 35C motion, and yet there was no appeal until 2013. And this is not a case. I mean, instances where there's good cause for a late appeal include where it's a direct appeal and the defendant has a right of direct review. Also instances where there has been ineffective assistance of counsel, the defendant had counsel, and counsel simply failed to effect the appeal on the defendant's behalf. Now, in the situation, it is not disputed that the defendant was pro se in the trial court and that the trial court properly served the defendant with the order in question here. So it's the people's position that the defendant was pro se. The record shows the defendant has the ability to act pro se in appealing and failed to do so in this case. And the fact that it's 500 days late drags out this case. It's dragged on forever already. With regard to the merits in this case, there were 8 issues that were raised in the 2002 pro se motion. It would seem that the last 6 of those issues have been abandoned by the defense because there's been no specific argument made either in the briefs or today about those issues. So we have 2 discrete issues, one concerning 1997 and the other concerning 1999. With regard to the first question, which was the 1997 competency hearings, the murder happened on July 1997, and it's clear from the record that McClure had previously represented the defendant before in other cases, and he entered his appearance the day after the murder on June 20th, 1997. It was the following month that he requested the defendant be evaluated for competency, and clearly the defendant did not agree with this decision of counsel. Counsel has an ethical obligation to raise such an issue, and it was raised here. And if we look at the September 4, 1997 letter written by the defendant, we see that the defendant is unhappy with counsel. He says he doesn't feel that counsel's taking his case seriously. He says that it's absolutely unnecessary that he be sent to the state hospital for evaluation. He says that he loved the victim dearly and that he has been framed for her murder. And so he's given a complete chance to flesh out these complaints, which are not in and of themselves enough to show a conflict or a complete breakdown with communication, at the September 15, 1997 hearing. And the court asks repeatedly, what else do you want to tell me? And mostly he just refers the court back to the written motion. So it's the people's position that the court made an effective inquiry at that time, and there was simply no showing of a conflict which would require replacement counsel.
Ms. Rohrbach, excuse me, could you also comment on whether you think the West case has fully overruled Castro or if there's some portions of Castro that are still intact?
Judge Dunn, I have to admit I'm not familiar with the West case, so I can offer no thoughts about it. Based on what defense counsel said here today, it seems like to the extent that it involved loyalties towards different clients, it might be a different situation, but I can't say because I haven't read the case.
Well, I appreciate your candor.
When we look at the 1999 allegation, the defendant said that he hit his counsel and called him a racist. It's important to look at the context of jury selection in this case. And in this case, right before jury selection, the trial court took up the issue of what restraints would be necessary for the defendant during the trial. And defense counsel argued that a lesser restraint than the React belt would be appropriate. And the court noted numerous assaultive incidents that had taken place at the jail. The court also noted the defendant being what the court called inappropriate in the courtroom and said that the restraints were going to be necessary for the safety of the defendant's lawyers, for the court staff, and for everyone in the courtroom. So I think it's a clear inference from this that the court had witnessed assaultive behavior between the defendant and his counsel up to that point. Now, there were a number of things that went on during jury selection. One thing that went on was that numerous jurors had said that they had had family members who'd been violently assaulted or died. So that was a part of the juror questioning. Some of those jurors were dismissed. Also during jury selection, the defendant's mother called a number of prospective jurors' names, and also the defendant himself was winking at prospective female jurors. And the court asked the defense counsel to have a conference with the defendant about the defendant's behavior. So they went into the jury room, and the next day, the court made a record of the fact that the defendant had threatened jail staff the night before, and also the fact that the court had heard the defendant cursing at counsel. Neither counsel nor the defendant offered further record at the time. But clearly, we have a defendant who has violent tendencies and who has been witnessed being assaulted towards his counsel. So, while, as I said in my brief, this allegation that he called counsel a racist and hit counsel may be new in the 35C motion, it's very consistent with other behavior he displayed in the course of the trial and does not constitute a reason that there was an actual conflict of counsel that adversely affected counsel's representation of the defendant. It's also important to note that this jury room conference, according to the defendant, was in the context of a discussion about whether a particular prospective juror should be dismissed because of having a family member who was stabbed to death. And as, again, the defendant recounts it in his motion, he thought that there should have been a challenge for cause, and defense counsel said, no, I can work with this juror. So clearly, they're having a discussion about trial strategy, and there is not a complete breakdown of communication. You can also then see this a few days later. The court offers the defense the option of mistrial after the prosecutor had a heart attack. And according to defense counsel, he and the defendant discussed the matter, and they both wanted to proceed with the trial after a two-day continuance to replace the prosecutor. So again, there's clear indication in the record that there is a communication between the defendant and counsel at this time, and that neither wants to continue the trial, which would have been a perfect point to have brought any such concerns to the attention of the court. If this court has no questions about the case, I would simply urge you to affirm the trial court's written order. Thank you.
Thank you.
Briefly on timeliness, I think everything that we need to say on timeliness is set forth in our reply brief. This issue was considered and addressed by a merits panel that exercised discretion in determining whether or not good cause had been shown, and on that basis allowed this appeal to go forward. And it wasn't until the answer brief, 14 months later, that the people first challenged this. With regard to what the trial court should have done, the Delgadillo case notes that the trial court has a duty to inquire into the propriety of continued representation if it knows or should have known that a conflict exists. It also notes the next sentence, a defendant should have the opportunity to discuss the conflict with either defense counsel or independent advisement counsel. Now, none of that happened during this perfunctory hearing on September 4th, 1997. As I noted, the trial court did not address defense counsel at all, didn't recess so that Mr. Moore could discuss it with defense counsel, and simply denied it on the spot and moved on to the competency determination. So in that sense, the trial court failed to do what the Delgadillo case, albeit later, says the court was required to do. With regard to the communication between counsel, I think it's important to note that Mr. Moore had no problem with public defender Lobato, the second chair, and that was made clear when he mentioned it. It was the conflict between him and Mr. McClure that was the problem. And on this record, there is enough to suggest that the communication between them was so bad, and the animosity was so bad, that there needed to be a hearing to determine whether that rose to the level of an actual conflict entitling Mr. Moore to some sort of relief if that affected his Mr. McClure's trial performance.
Mr. Myron?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Kel.
Should we be bound by a motions division that grants a motion to accept an out-of-time appeal? Do we not have the discretion as a merits division to overturn the motions division decision?
I believe you actually do have the authority. I don't think it's a question of power, but I think it's a question that this has already been considered, and we've gone pretty far down the road.
So should we consider it de novo? Should we take a look at the record before us and determine whether just cause existed for Mr. Moore to file an out-of-time appeal?
Well, I would suggest the court doesn't need to, but if the court does, then I think the record supports that. Everything that's put in the motion, the fact that the court didn't send me as appellate counsel and knew that I was appellate counsel a copy of the order, I think is what sort of started the train wreck here.
So, Mr. Myron, I just want to go back to 1999. And I want to make sure I understand all the evidence you say that should have triggered the hearing, the evidentiary hearing. So you have the allegation that he was winking at jurors. The court counseled counsel to talk to Mr. Moore. Mr. Moore and counsel come out of a room, and there's some cussing. Are those the basic facts that should have triggered the
hearing? Well, that is what the trial court should have stopped and looked into that, particularly given the history of the case and the previous request for new counsel. That's what should have triggered the trial court on the spot. The 35C court had more evidence or more allegations in terms of what Mr. Moore revealed in his discussions between defense counsel that were not in the trial.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course. As soon as counsel can set up a